Welcome back, everybody. Just a few thank yous. I'd just like to thank Lars and his team for the delicious lunch and for their wonderful hospitality. And also thanks to Jim and the fantastic speakers this morning. I'm sure you will agree it was a really interesting and enriching session with lots more to come. So we are now moving along to case studies, and I'm delighted to introduce Professor Sue Ann Gardner of the University of Nebraska Lincoln. And Sue Ann's talk is wonderfully inspiring. Inspiring in terms of its title, Small but Mighty, How a Team of Four Administers a Robust Library Publishing Program. Thank you, Sue Ann.
Thank you for introducing me and for being here. I have the after lunch slot here, so I'm going to try to perk everybody up. So yes, Small but Mighty. I prepared way too much for this, so I'm going to speed through it. Apologies if it's too quick. These will be online if you need to see them afterward. And if you have questions, just contact me anytime. I love to talk about this. So thank you for inviting me. My co-author on this is Paul Royster. He isn't here with me today, and but he helped me prepare this. So this is our talk. UNL Repository and Publishing Program. UNL is University of Nebraska Lincoln. I'll soon show you on a map where we are. I'm going to give you a quick overview. We're a state land grant university, so it's a public university. And we're a Research One Carnegie designated university, meaning it's a very high research output. We're the largest library in the state and the largest academic library in the state, of course, too. We have about 26,000 students. We're in this particular academic alliance, and our mascot is the Cornhuskers. So this is where we are in the country, really in the middle of the country. We're not coastal or, you know, Gulf there. So that's Nebraska. We have over 109,000 items, full text items in our repository. We've had 62 million downloads of our work, 8.2 million in the past year alone. We have over 80 scholarly monographs, 9 original journal titles, and several mirror titles. 15,000 of those 109 full text items are ETDs, electronic theses and dissertations, and there's our URL. So how have we done this? We were two for a long time. From 2005 to 2014, it was Paul Royster and I working on this together. I came on board in 2008. In 2014, we were able to add a third person. And it's a fun story to talk about how we acquired her, but I don't really have time. But the short version of it is that she and Paul worked together at the University of Nebraska Press, and they were both riffed, which is a kind way of saying they were let go in a downsizing event. And it was to our advantage. We were able to acquire them in the library. What I'm going to talk about today, some of it is idiosyncratic, meaning it's particular to our instance. It doesn't necessarily translate into other instances, but some of these are key and probably do translate in more generally. So here are some clues about how we've done what we've done. Some of the principles that we operate under are these. So the repository, we think, is a publisher beyond anything else. It's not a collection. It's not an archive. We think of it as a set of services. This is from Cliff Lynch of CNI, Coalition for Networked Information. It says that this is one way that you can come at repositories, and this is how we do it. Our works are provided, the works that we provide are access copies. So we don't think of these as preservation. We try to shovel content onto the web so that people can read things for free. We have all kinds of reuse policies that cover this. It's not an OA repository. It's an institutional repository with lots of different copyright copyright regime. Okay, so the workflows for the material types are all very similar. So that's one reason we can do what we do. So we have the repository, we have a publishing program that does journals and books, and we have open educational resources. And the reason we can do this all the same is because the workflows are very similar. And like I said, public access is what guides us more than anything else. I'm going to bring in Raghunathan here throughout the talk, and books are for use, and that's the way we think about it. We want to get books out there for people to use however they need them. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our staff. We do have four of us. Paul is our coordinator. I'm the scholarly communications librarian. We have a metadata person, and Linnea is our copy editor. And how we came to be is just random. This was not like a crack team that was created. This is the Island of Misfit Toys from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. This is a television program that's shown in the United States every year for the past 50 years. And these are the unwanted toys. We just sort of fell in together, and we became a very dynamic team. And I think that it was a benefit that we weren't kind of constructed, you know. It was more organic. And we got along well with each other, which really helped. Okay, so here we are, pictures of us in our best form, I guess. But what I want to say about us is there's no hierarchy here. The images in a linear fashion is intentional. Paul is not our leader. I'm not our leader. Margaret's not. And Linnea's not. We all work together, co-leading. So some relevant characteristics that make us work well together. We all have a very strong public service motivation. Linnea was working for IBM when she came on board, and she couldn't wait to get away from there. It wasn't for her. We said, you'll have to take a pay cut. You know, we work really hard and this and that. She said, sign me up. Two of us are from a publishing background. Paul was CEO or CFO or something at Library of America. They had a $5 million budget when he left. And that's a scholarly publishing venture in the United States, and he worked for Yale University Press. Linnea's from the University of Nebraska Press. Margaret and I are career librarians, and we feel very fortunate to be working with these amazing people. They taught us everything they know. We do have a very industrious disposition. I wanted to say, not to say we're workaholic, it's just that if you're going to think about like weeding the garden or working on our publishing, I don't know, we'd rather just sit at our computer and do this instead. We have a good sense of humor with each other, and like I already said, we co-lead, which is a key aspect. So we all have our own specializations. Paul is really good at typesetting. Linnea is a professionally trained copy editor. And Margaret and I have metadata and bibliographic searching as our expertise. We've taught each other everything, and I can sit down and do typesetting on par with Paul. Honestly, he says so. So we just sit down and all do a bit of everything, and it's great. So if you're sick of doing something, you can change what you're doing. It's good to be able to mix that up. And as I said, we have really strong group cohesion. We have joy in our work, and it gives us, we have a sense of purpose. We see the metrics, and we're just motivated by seeing how this work is probably transforming practices and scholarship around the world. So we're looking to increase our team of 4 to 5. We're recruiting someone specifically now. Paul and I are on our charm offensive trying to get this person to work with us. And her expertise is teaching, and I think that's something that we lack. We do some teaching, but she will go out and, you know, promote our work in a way that we aren't maybe able to do. So we're united in our common goal, and we're team-oriented, and I already said these things. So, you know, if you look into the research about group size and what's effective, you'll read in many places in the management literature that smaller groups can be more productive. They can be more engaged. There's no hierarchy. I don't have to ask Paul, may I do this or something like that. I just do what needs to be done. We all do. You can't get lazy. I mean, you could, I suppose, but we don't want to. We want to hang out with each other and get this work done. So that's a benefit. We really know each other very well. We know each other personally and professionally, and this works for us. I discovered this recently. There's a concept called micro-solidarity that kind of explains some of what I'm talking about here. Richard Bartlett is an independent researcher talking about this kind of dynamic. Paul and I were a partnership, and now we've turned into a crew. And our congregation is the people in this room and beyond, okay? So we're doing good works together. There was a question this morning from you, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, yes, about costs and things like that, so I do have a little bit that I'm going to talk about here. But what does this cost? It's our salaries and overhead, benefits, our equipment, and our platform and preservation. This is the extent of our costs. Basically, salaries is the main cost. Our platform is very inexpensive, and the person who spoke last, I'm sorry, I don't remember your name, was talking about the benefits, the triangle, you know, cost, effort, and the other thing. Anyway, so cost is important to us. It's very low, and we can't customize it. That's what it was, control. So we don't have as much control that we have a really good relationship with our vendor, and I'll talk about them briefly later, so that we can customize it through them. But we don't do it ourselves. And preservation, like locks or something, portico is what we have used. So skills, I'll just quickly go through skills. These are the skills that you need, the skill sets. People and technical skills are the real ones that make what we do work well. The administrative and library skills are kind of subordinate. They're important, but not critically. They're not like front and center. Among people skills, we have these different relationships that we create with the authors, with the readers, with the vendors, and internally within the library. So I'll go quickly through these. Now, in terms of author relations, to me, this is the most central, important aspect. These people create our content. And how we do it, because we have a small staff, we don't have the opportunity to do it systematically. We have a new dean, and she's asking us to think about doing it systematically, meaning everyone in a department will get coverage, or a new person comes on and we're sure to include that person. We don't have the staff to do it systematically. So how we do it is I go out and I just meet everybody I can, and I ask them, is your stuff in the repository? And when they say it isn't, we get it on. We just put it on. And depending on how large their corpus is, that will determine how we go about it. If they have 350 articles and it goes over 35 years, we say we'll go back to the year 2010 to start, or something like that. If someone has a smaller corpus, we get everything online. So anyway, we have our workflows. I'll talk just a little bit about them. So we have a huge network after all this time. I think we have 60% coverage in our large university just doing it this way. We get to know these people. We care about them. They become our friends sometimes. They guide our direction. I think this is really important. They tell us what they want, and we accommodate. We work with them in a co-production sense. We don't impose our values on them too much. We ask them what they want, and we try to accommodate them. In terms of readers, we feel like they benefit. When we take care of the author, the reader incidentally gets cared for. So we do focus less on the reader directly. But Ranganathan comes in here as well, where every reader has his or her book. We like to think that our small publishing venture is very diverse in what we're offering, and there will be sort of something for everyone there. Every book has its reader. Even the most obscure things that we put in our repository end up getting downloads. It's really amazing to see what people are interested in, and save the time of the reader. We try to maximize the download speed and that kind of thing when we upload things. Readers help us discover problems. This is hugely important. They co-produce with us in that way. And I won't give you an example just in the interest of time, but you can take my word for that. So people skills, vendor relations, this is very important. Paul was telling me that this is sort of overlooked in what we do. And with our platform provider, we need to, we need to work with them. They can't read our mind. They need to hear from us. We need to be very direct with them about what we expect, and we expect them to accommodate us. So we work with a proprietary platform, and we have wonderful relationship with them. And then internal relations, I'm really going to gloss over this. At the very least, your top leadership has to be on your side, at least to start. But your biggest fans might not be on the inside. There's been a lot of misunderstanding about what we do, friction, and internal relations can be quite challenging, we find. But it's all part of it, and it's unique to every situation. So, technical skills. second most important, or equally important with people skills, I should say. So in technical, we acquire content, we edit it, we publish it, and then we have our library-related skills. People skills come into play with all of this. Within reason, I promote my services everywhere. I go to parties. I'm, you know, meeting my kids' parents. If they're a part of the university, I'm always talking about what we do and that we've really gotten wonderful projects doing this. And I have my collection development policy in mind when I'm doing this, because sometimes people will say, oh, I have this memoir, or I wrote a cookbook, you know, and that's not what we do. So I tell them what we do and we go from there. So for editing, proper copy editing is a professional level skill. Now, Linnea has taught me a lot of what she knows, but there's no way I will ever be up to her level with copy editing. It's a professional level skill. It's very important in original publishing to have proper copy editing. Before she came on board in 2014, you'll see evidence of the fact that we did not have proper copy editing. We did our best, but it's really great if you can get a copy editor on board. Copy editing doesn't have to, though, be any certain thing. We like to promote what we call global English, so we don't standardize the English all the time. We have a lot of Global South authors, and we honor their way of expressing themselves. As a baseline, serviceable copy editing and proofreading are a must in everything you do. I mean, you have to do some, even if you can't do it to the level that Linnea does. So for technical skills publishing, we decide what size of the item it'll be, you know, how many centimeters and that kind of thing. The overall production values, the typesetting, the graphics layout, cover art and design, and the scanning. And then we think about all these other ancillary things that are also critically important, copyright, licensing, branding, and DOIs and that kind of thing. So administrative skills are co-leading the way we do it there, and then we do create some policy, but we keep this to a minimum. I'll show you a screenshot of how little we have, really. We do have metrics. We do evaluate our program every year. These are requirements. We do them, and we think they're valuable, but we put kind of as little time into them as we can get away with, frankly, so that we can keep working. Environmental scanning is very important. You know, see what is happening out in the university. We plan on that basis. Our environmental scanning and planning are very fleet, so we're quick to change what we are going to be focusing on depending on what's happening out in the community. Communicating is very important. We meet occasionally. We liaise with people, but again, we kind of minimize all of that. And then platform and technology management is another thing, of course, that we have to do. All of this, you'll see, I'll show you. I won't talk about the percentage of effort here. So the last Ranganathan here for library skills. The library is a growing organism. We feel that we very much contribute to this. So what do we do as librarians? Bibliographic searching, interlibrary loan, metadata creation, evaluation, and so on. All of these things. We do a lot of copyright consultation, and that's one of our favorite things. So quickly, workflows. We just have this way of doing it. Give us your CV and we do everything else. We do mediated deposit. We don't expect anybody to upload things. We do all of it. And this is to prevent problems, because when others upload their own work, They upload illegal copies, or they don't credit their co-authors, and various other problems. It's just quicker for us to do it, and we enjoy it. Here's just a quick thing about our document specifications. We have all kinds of different variations, but this is the general thing that we will follow. So this is what I was trying to get at. Really, we try to focus on production above all. All that stuff about typesetting, copy editing, acquisition, that's our production. I guess editing is in there too. So now with Linnea, we do quite a bit more of editing. That might even be up to 15%. This might be a little bit different. I did this a couple of years ago. Access and metadata kind of minimize that aspect of things. Administration, as I just said, we really try to keep it to a minimum. That 2% is a goal of ours because we think it's what we need to do. It's not, you know, we're not shirking our responsibility. We think that doing more wouldn't really give us much more of a benefit. So platform. Quickly, we use BPress Digital Commons. This is a proprietary platform. and it's worked very well for us. We were one of its first adopters. They have really nice back-end functioning that works well for us and our users. So I just said some of the things. It's very economical. They have excellent search engine optimization. Our results get up there with Wikipedia often. And they have a tech startup ethos. We really appreciate that about them, even after Elsevier purchased them. So just quickly, this is some selected metrics because of the audience here. Paul selected these particularly. So just in the last year, we've had about 11,000 downloads from Norway, which is about, 0.002 per capita, which is on par with other non-English speaking countries. And you can see the UK, an English speaking country, it's about double per capita the number of downloads per year there. And then I'm going to just go through these. You can see them online. Oh, and I see I have to fix that formatting there. But I did pull them out for Sweden and Norway and others. So what material types do we have? And I'm running long, so I'll try to speed through this. We have originally published journals. This is the cover of one example, Sequential Art Narrative in Education. And this is the list of titles that we have that are originally published with us. So we co-produce for this. We don't do everything. We partner with scholars to publish these journals. We do provide some editorial support. We do the typesetting and graphics layout, but the scholars outside the library acquire the content. They're the editors. They're the peer review administrators. And like you were saying earlier from the Netherlands, we let them choose how they do it. Peer review is one thing. They can choose how they wish to do that. Journal editors have control over the rights regime. They can have the authors retain copyright, or it can be CC0. It can be anything they want it to be. None of our journals is monetized or firewalled. Thank you. 5 minutes. So this was the other thing I wanted to get to about money. How much does this cost? We find that we can publish our journals and books for between $6 and $8 per page. Dollars and euros are about equivalent, okay? For PLOS One, it's about $100 per OA page if you pay the APC. So it's an order of magnitude different what we can do. Now, we're limited in the number of things we can do. So ours might be a lot cheaper, but we can't offer to do as many as they do. PNAS, that's Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S., is more expensive, and Elsevier Wiley is quite a bit more yet again. So this is, one thing that we think we can offer that makes us, why would you go with us? We can do it very cost effectively. So just breaking it down, $100,000 or approximately the same number of euros, we can do almost, over 1,000 original library published articles for this. It's like 1,040. And then you can only get up to 100 articles with this. And that's at the lower end of the APCs. At the higher end, you're only going to get in the 20s, 25 or so. So we're an order of magnitude less expensive. So just quickly, some of our some things about OERs, and we could call also these things FOLO, which is free online learning objects. This is distinguished from OER, which is necessarily Creative Commons open. Free online learning objects are free to access, not necessarily available for reuse. So this is what Paul came up with for a definition. They're pedagogical materials on connected lessons and so on, just a variety of things. It's a larger, looser category. And these get downloaded tremendously. I mean, there's a metric I didn't add, but they get downloaded about 5 times more frequently than other types of materials in our repository. So here are some examples of FOLOs or OERs we have in our repository. The physics book has been downloaded 200,000 times. And then our books. So it's scholarly content. And the thing I wanted to emphasize here is that we have a commitment to bibliodiversity, global authorship, global readership. We don't just focus on our local readership. And we do context-dependent editorial editing because We let the project dictate our editorial approach. We have a very streamlined production. Paul and I have lots of conversations about what from commercial publishing we're able to cut out, marketing and graphics in a certain way and all these other things. We have a pluralist approach to property rights. So this is just for your enjoyment later. What do we mean by scholarly? I'm going to wrap up here. Bibliodiversity is really what I wanted to emphasize here. We feel it promotes freedom of speech. It promotes cultural and intellectual diversity. And I already said it allows for these non-standard editing and formatting decisions. It's motivated by an alliance between the author and the reader and us, as opposed to us telling them what to do. And this term was first used in Chile in the 1990s. So just in terms of workflows, we have style guides. For each project, we change it. It's so you're not going to see a Zio Books publishing house style. It's not like that. So you'll see some variation in production value because of that. We know what our bottom line is, and we stick to that, and we go out from there. So these things are essential. I'm just going to really skip through here. And then other things are not essential. Managing authors is not essential. That's something that Paul was really happy to let go from commercial publishing. And I guess that's it. So this is just our policies. We have four. Okay, it's very minimal, and you're welcome to look at these. And this is just a screenshot from one of those policies. So we partner with scholars, and they do all of this, and we do our in-house stuff, and we use lulu.com for our hard copies. Print on demand, at cost. We make no money on this. We don't want to. That would be a nightmare for paperwork. So I already talked about this, and I think that's about it. Just these are the takeaways. We do not want to emulate university presses. We do not want to emulate commercial publishers. We want to take advantage of our small press publishing technologies and connectivity. We want to make it our own, and we want everyone to make it their own. The goals are to give scholars a voice. We want high-quality scholarly content available to readers. We have gotten some friction and pushback from the community and internally in our library about our approach, but we're persevering. We don't have to be everything to every person, and neither does anybody in this room. Collectively, we bring this enterprise to scale. Our audience is global, not just local, but you're one of the only people who can bring local content to the world, so we do keep that in mind as well. So these are some metrics, and I'll just skip through. These are some book covers, and I'm going to end with this. So that's all I have. Thank you for letting me go on.
Thank you, Sue-Ann. It's actually wonderful to get an insight into the entire team behind that wonderful body of work. Thank you for your talk. Next, I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Katarzyna Weinpern of Lublin University of Technology in Poland, whose talk will explore the experience of the LUT publishing house with particular reference to open access. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Weinpern Katarzyna, and I work in publishing house and in Center of Scientific and Technical Information in Lublin University of Technology. I would like to tell you something about open access on our university and about whole publishing process. Heading for the open science, so it will be a short story of experience of... Could you maybe kind of try that?
A few words about the city and Poland.
A few words about Poland and Lublin. It's the largest city on the east side of Poland. It's on 170 kilometers on southeast of Warsaw, capital of Lublin, of Poland. And here you can see the photos from the city. Lublin is the academic city. We have five public universities. Marie Curie Skłodowska University, Catholic University, Medical University, Life Science University also, and the technology. So we have also five private, so it's the big academic city. Lublin University of Technology was established in 1954 as an evening high school, technical high school, and after that became a high engineering school, and in 77 became a university. That's why the buildings are in different technical style. All these buildings are gathered on campus, and you can see photos from the libraries in these buildings. We've got five faculties. Here are listed four of them: civil engineering and architectural faculty, mechanical engineering, environmental engineering, management faculty, and fundamentals of technology. We've got also engineering faculty of engineering and computer science, electrical engineering. This is our homepage. As you can see, it is a center of scientific and technical information. There is bibliometric analysis, library in the middle, and publishing house. Library was the superior unit, and last year became a part of Center of Scientific and Technical Information. And here we can see that we are all librarians, and we are working together. I work as a librarian, as an editor also, in publishing house. Here's a little bit of our story. We publish in open access since 2008. In 2008, it was a year when digital library was established. And with the rector's announcement, we started to work in a publishing and digital library center. We have a publishing board, and the first doctoral thesis, dissertations, were published in our digital library on open access, in open access in 2011. Last year was very important for us. We returned to the name Lublin Publishing, Lublin University of Technology Publishing House, and we started to create our journals platform based on OJS. Here you can see covers of our dissertations. They are available in our digital library. We have also our homepage. It's in Polish right now, but we are in the middle of changing, so I think it will be also in English. We have here most important thing, the publishing policy, guide for authors, and information about books in print, and a link to OJS also. This is our publishing model. We do published our monographs, textbooks, and proceedings materials always after the review process. Then we do layout and typographical correction on PDFs, and we decided it will be easier, and the cost will be lower. And after the typographical correction, we put the PDF. One of our colleagues makes description of the book and puts it in the digital library. And the same description of the book goes to the National Universal Central Catalog, it's called NUCAT, and it's global. It's WordCat, so they take description also from our national. And we call it publication dualism. The printed version of the book is the same that we put in the digital library. Here are our covers. Our monographs have the same layout, unified. As you can see, yellow and blue. proceedings materials, yellow and green, and books that depends on of the faculty. Because the needs of our academics were growing, we decided to publish also special editions, other monographs, books about the region, about history of technique, and others. Here you can see the difference in covers of our textbooks and monographs. We have books in English, mostly in Polish, of course, but also in English, in Russian, and in Ukrainian. We want to be open, not only we know that needs of our academics are growing, but also of our students. So we are thinking also about this group of students. And here you can see there is an example of a textbooks. It's a brochure brochure book. It fits to apron pocket if they go to lab activities. They have a book in this format. The cost of this book is about €1, so they don't have to go to the copy point to do a copy or to take the PDF from digital library. They can buy, and it's a cheap version. So here I've got a slide with our digital library. We've got 10 collections. You can see there is a collection with textbooks, with scientific publications, standards, PhD theses. All of our books and textbooks are in open access on license CC BY-SA. Also, dissertations are available for public, and this is the example of the book. We may download the content, or we may read it online. It's a monograph. Here are a slide with the visits in digital library. You can see it's growing. It's very popular. Last year, we've implemented a platform based on OJS. We have 6 journals. We are publisher or co-publisher. Nowadays, we will have 3 more. They are also on in open access on the CC BY license. You can see the logo and logo of open access and the logo of license. And here is an example of one of our journals and article. I know that you know very well the platform. This is our team. We are also in 4, like in Nebraska. We do other things, not only we take part in promotional activities on our university. We take part in Open Day and in Fair Jobs. We promote our books. And we do also some workshop for students and for academics. Here is a photo from the last Lublin Science Festival. You can see our books. And we do also stamps, occasional stamps, commemorative stamps for our university. It's our activity in publishing house. That would be all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Katarzyna. Another wonderful example of library publishing and how it can contribute to open access publishing generally, and really interesting to find out about the promotional activities as well. Next, I'd like to introduce Markus Stumpf of Vienna University Library, who will speak on the Vienna University Press and its publications. Thank you, Markus.
My name is Markus Stumpf. I'm a librarian historian and provenance researcher at the University of Vienna. And also, that's the reason why I'm here. I'm a co-editor of a book series at the Vienna University Press. So I have to make clear first that I'm not speaking for the Vienna University Press. I'm more speaking in the role of a librarian and an editor in this at the Vienna University Press. After a general introduction into Vienna, into the University of Vienna, I will focus on Vienna University Press, its mode of operation, and its publication program. Afterwards, we will take a look at selected figures and download figures. And for this, I have to say I'm very grateful to Mr. Ketch from Vienna University Press, because normally you don't see these figures. When Duke Rudolf IV founded the University of Vienna in 1365, he also established a university library. Thus, Vienna University Library is the oldest university library in the German-speaking world. Today, the University of Vienna is very big, with almost 100,000 members. That includes more than 90,000 students and more than 9,000 staff members. The figures shown here are for 2017 and give an indication of the library's performance as well. In Austria, we are the largest library, even larger as the National Library, and we have also the largest electronic media collection of all Austrian libraries. And in the early 2000s, university publishing and library publishing became a topic at rectorate level, but starting with monographs. And so in this course, in 2007, Vienna University Press was founded as an imprint and in cooperation with the University of Vienna and Vandenheck and Ruprecht. This is a renowned humanities publisher in Göttingen, Germany. The Vienna University steers the publishing program through a scientific advisory board and agrees upon the publisher's range of services. Vienna University Library wants to publish qualified research works, edited collection on specific topics and monographs, research reports, habilitations, and so on. One part of the scientific advisory board is the head of the library of the Vienna University Library and Archive Service. Doing so is fitting to its other activities in this field, like running an open access office, running the repository, doing research data for the university, giving the DOAs, ORCID IDs, e-theses, running the open journal system, doing the bibliometric services and all the things. So this fits quite into the whole range what the university library is doing. Vienna University Press currently is publishing 20 book series. So that's what I'm talking about the book series, as well as a number of books, of monographs, that are not part of the series. And to some extent, Vienna University Press is published open access. All volumes of Vienna University Press are peer-reviewed. The scientific advisory board decides about the book series. If they are accepted, then the editors of this book series are doing the review process as however they decide at which faculty and at which seems appropriate to their standards. So every 3 years, the scientific advisory board also reviews the book series. And Also important, I think, external scientists can become also editors of a book series. So if the book series is also clearly linked to the university. I think this is a wise and promising decision compared with other university presses because it incorporates other scientists. Monographs that are not part of a book series of Vienna University Press will be reviewed with external reviewers and the scientific advisory board. Printed books. So all published books are in print and parallel as an e-book and presented in the webshop of Van den Hoek & Ruprecht. And also the articles, chapters of a book will be published in the e-library of the publishing company. And if you want to have your book open access, there are just two book series where it's clearly said that the books have to be open access. In all other cases, the authors decide by themselves if they choose open access or if they want to go along with a traditional way of publishing. To talk about the costs, it's about open access with Van den Hoek & Ruprecht. So we talk, if we have a book with about 300 pages, it would cost about 5,000 euro to put it on open access. This is a lot of money, but there are some funding programs at the university, so you can apply at the rectorate or even at the Vienna University Library Services to get co-funding. Okay, all these books get DOEs and all things. For if you're open access, you're in UOPEN or the Directory of Open Access Books, and so on. And each book can be, after 18 months, become open access. Yeah, that's very important, and this was, I think, a good decision. And therefore, they can be, and that's the, let's say, the problem also, because if the authors agree to it. And so we could give them open access, but we have to handle with the authors that they allow this. And believe me, if they have decided to not put it open access, it's a hard work to talk to them that they allow it afterwards. So these are the book series titles. And you see this 20 journal. There are 20 book series and just one journal. Four titles are from history, three titles from theology. You see this all this humanities range here. And I have to say, of course, the University of Vienna has a lot of more other programs. So this is just a small portion of what we are publishing. And just two series are clearly open access. That's the Gunnar Hering lectures of Byzantine studies and the co-edited Library in Context, Bibliothek in Context book series. So if you look at the selected sale figures in print in the last 2 years, you see, well, it's not very much. So, of course, we have the tradition of traditional books, but, well, nobody is really impressed, I would say, by these figures. Yeah. But still, it's interesting if you look here, open access, and I'm looking here, the second title from above, Treuhändische Übernahme und Verwahrung, that's a book about provenance research, fiduciary holdings in trust, so nobody's interested in this title normally. Yeah, but still, if you put it open access, it was bought 31 times in print copy. So I'm really interested. I found this very interesting. So, and then Fandenegg im Drupprecht has his web shop. And you see open access, this 6 books, open access, download figures in 2 years. What you don't know about it, that there was a major problem at the web shop. Yeah, they bought another public companies and they merged them together. So they didn't work at all. So we have this not very impressive figures here. But if you look at the e-library, where you have not where you picture down the content of one article, you get a little bit a better impression. So our best-selling article is always the yoga. So, you know, Vienna is very important and very famous for this yoga. And even so, I have to say this, we have a yoga group at the library, yeah? He's meeting twice, we're meeting twice a week doing this. And it's supported from the director, so it's very nice. And I really think that the most downloads from this title are from this group. So, but we are doing other things also. And for my title, like here, where I coded it, the Treuhänderische Übernahme und Verwahrung, I think it's interesting that it comes to a figure where I can live with it. 1,000 times, 1,100 times downloads for a really for the public not interesting title. That's fine. I can really live with this. Yeah, that's okay. And it's open access, so it doesn't say where in other repositories or whatever, wherever it was downloaded. Well, I'm coming to an end. So I think for my co-edited books as library and contexts, these figures are very important. This has also to do with a special situation of library and information science in Austria. Since there's not a single professorship at the university in this field of science, it is even more complex to get any funding for it, because we are normally just seen as administrative staff. And that's a role I don't think that's quite fitting. Yeah. It's okay, it's part of it, but we are doing other things as well. And also I'm doing and running this book series because I'm deeply convinced that libraries have to go in this field. And if I want to know what my scientists are doing, I have to come to become myself a scientist as well. Otherwise, I would never will understand what the other historians at my faculty, what their needs are. So I'm really very grateful also to the Vienna University Library that I can do this in this double role. That's I think that makes gives information and things vice versa to the faculty and back to the university library. However, another challenge that has to be confronted is that Vienna University Press should be more and more considered as the first choice to publish a book for scientists. But how to get our scientists there? That's a big topic, because one of the academic freedoms is to choose where to publish. Yeah. So, but we should be more interesting with this product. And I think, therefore, it should be more open. So there, Vienna University, there are leagues of historians who are not at the university, who are not working there, but they are still private researchers. They're doing what researchers do, and they're publishing, but they do it not. They publish not the books at Vienna University, but they are came and they had they came from the Vienna University. So why not considering them as a very important field? And furthermore, I have to say, in German-speaking countries, we are not that small, like the Danish or so, but still, we have to accept that nobody else is understanding German. Yeah, so we have to form other ways. We do all the books with abstracting, with keywords in English. Well, I think there should be more shift for internationalization and to doing these things more, if appropriate, in English. Yeah. And I think that would be good for the aim that we have to maximize dissemination, visibility, and impact of our researchers. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcus. I think two very powerful words there, open and international, and also impact as well. And I think that theme is coming through very strongly today. Next, I would like to introduce Professor Goran Trajljevic of the City Library of Pančevo in Serbia. And Goran will be speaking on publishing in the public library sector in Serbia. Thank you, Goran.
Thank you. I work in a public library as a library advisor and editor. And I want to say at the very beginning, when we say to public, we think in general to print. There are a lot of web pages, digital collection, and let's see, e-books, but they are more PDFs, the final version for printing than real e-books. Okay, it's a brief presentation, and I'll say something only about journal, library journal, and about book. It's a little bit specific journal, the scientific journal on theory and practice of librarianship specific, but because it's the most influenced library journal in Serbia. You can see Kavo, it's some reading room of state library in St. Petersburg. Everything about the library you can see on this web address. Some guidelines and structure and so on. To say a few words, there are a long tradition for publishing books and journals, journals and books. And in Pančevo, this is the first publication, 1936. I don't know if it's a long tradition or not. And we are a little bit specific. We are specialized for this library journal and books about librarianship and cultural history. And we really have great authorities in this field. I don't give names, but believe me. We really publish the most, it is an oral and Serbian book in this field. And from the very beginning, for the monastery libraries, till the Second World too. But of course, we have different books, like this best practice is 22 stories about communication, organization, culture, and labor public relations. There are some authors from this book, our American colleagues. You know some of these names, I suppose. And I want to pay attention one book, one study. It's Library for Time, a contribution to the general history of libraries up to the 60th centuries. And it says, but Professor Gordon Simoncic. I leave the book and the journal here, and you can find introduction and abstract on English at Academia Edu. This is the cover. And we really are looking for some co-publishers about this book, and I have an idea to make some great projects in IFLA and to cover all the world to find the best authors and to this project generally. We are very willing to share our experience, to information, and to foster our group and coalition. Ask me nothing, but write me on my mail address. I live in this mail address, and I will try to answer you as soon as possible and to answer any of your questions to give you any kind of help or support.
Thank you, Goran. Some really interesting titles there that have incredible reach, and lovely also your call there for further dialogue and cooperation, which I think SIG will help with today. The last speaker in the case study section is Mikael Burke from Finland, who was formerly of Helsinki City Library, who will speak on the public library as publisher. Michael very kindly also circulated a book on this topic via the Library Publishing Coalition before this talk. Thank you to him for that. So with further ado.
Do you think that the public library is a publisher? If you think that the public library is a publisher, do you think that it can become a better publisher? I discussed these questions with two of my friends, Ralph Amisa, who lives in New York and who is a developer, mentioned here, a developer, a technical guy, and who has actually produced something like a library publishing system. But that was already in the 1990s. And the techniques and approaches of developers have changed much since then. The other one is Anders Eriksson. Anders, can you stand up? Anders is here. He's a local Norwegian librarian and journalist, and I cooperate with him. Anders runs a blog called The Library Takes Up the Case, and we are supposed to speak about cases here. A journal which you probably have heard about. They have this doomsday clock, and they make a new correction of the clock each time they find through their analysis of the situation in the world that the situation is closer or more far from midnight, and they have just now set the clock closest to midnight that it has ever been, 100 seconds. They think that the situation is the world in the world is that bad. I showed that because I think Bauerman's question needs updating. And I have tried to make for this present situation suitable question, and that would be, is IFLA capable of supporting the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons? And this is in our dialogue and the e-booklet. It's quite a big part of it is about that, discussing what this question actually could mean. I must say something about this question and IFLA as I can from my point of view. You know, there is ICAN, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, which won the Nobel Prize in 2017. And it has a number of partner organizations. And just to motivate why I think IFLA could become a partner of this ICAN, which was the motor behind the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which is supported by 126 states. No, of the not by the nuclear states and their allies, but other states. And it's led by a smart person, Beatrice Feen, and you see some faces just here. Well, among the partners, I thought I would mention two. One is the WILPF, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. It's the oldest women's peace organization. So it's quite logical they would be there. Another, which I think is particularly interesting from the point of view of librarians or the institution of the library, is Majors for Peace. That is the majors of some 7,000, more than 7,000 cities, big and small, in all over the world, have formed an campaign organization for the abolition of nuclear weapons already years ago. It's led by the major of Hiroshima. And now the cities are somewhere in between the states and the civil societies. And I think this goes for the libraries as well. And the libraries have a certain autonomy, and the library associations certainly have it. And IFLA is actually defining itself as a non-governmental, independent organization. So I think it could. Already in Dublin in August, announced that it will now join the international campaign for abolishing nuclear weapons. Um, Last year in Dublin, at this midterm meeting, there was a nice example of library publishing. Helen Fallon presented a book with the letters of Nigerian writer and social activist Ken Saro Wiwa. They were his last letters, and he sent them to a nun in Ireland called Marie. It's difficult for me to remember the name, but I have it here in my notes. But let's not go too deep in it anyway. This book was published, incidentally, by university librarians at the University of Maynooth. And it is called Silence Would Be Treason. So I don't see why it could not have been also published by public librarians working in a public library. I asked, can the public library become better as a publisher? A little side jump here is that when I published that definition of library publishing, which Wikipedia has to this list, I got an answer in private from an Irishman who asked me if I could give examples of public library publishing in Finland. And indeed, I could give him several examples. For instance, local history, also some books, actually books even where I have been involved, which were like published at least in the library world, so to speak. But to sort of make the point clear, one should say that this book, you can say that it is a good book, and it is well edited. I have read in it. But the essential goodness of this book is 5 minutes left. Do I have 5 minutes? Great. I thought I'm already coming to the end. Thank you. The essential goodness of this book is actually political. If it is scholarly, then all the better. It's still better, but the essential goodness of this book is political. And so I take another example of a book which is I don't say that it is unscholarly, but it is not academic and it is not scientific, because it is a book of confessions of a nuclear war planner. Daniel Ellsberg might not be very well known for people who were not grown up in the 1960s and 70s, but he is a world famous author and whistleblower. And some years ago, he published a new whistleblowing he released new information like he once did about the Vietnam War. So this is an example of a book which I have looked how many there are in the libraries in Finland and Sweden. I have not looked in the whole world. There were very few of them. So I don't know how popular this book is among the public at large. And I have... There was some kind of pointing, but I have not used this there. This quotation tells it. I will not read it now, but the idea is that there are two big crises, the climate crisis and the nuclear threat, and they are deeply intertwined. But only one of them is very much debated in the public. But the nuclear threat is sort of put aside. It's forgotten. Ellsberg here at the end of his book, and in this is from an interview with him actually, he just notes that economically mankind cannot have both these enormous military investments and investments in nuclear weapons and mitigating of the climate crisis. That's economically impossible, but there's so much to say about that, and I will not go deeper into it, but I have concentrated my, let's call it opinion, in this thesis that the library must take the disarmament case to the public, and then this it would be very good if IFLA joined ICANN and so gave a direction to all the library association in the world to take up this case of the nuclear threat. And I have even gone so far that I say that silence would be library treason. And this is perhaps a strange concept, but in this publication we go a little bit deeper in. Because Ralph, for example, he questioned immediately this concept, but I have tried to defend it there. I shall not do it now. Instead, I must say that I have focused on this one case in order to make myself clear, but there are, of course, many more cases and interesting questions about the public library as a publisher. Now they have gone. Now it's end. But I just say that I already had the possibility to mention the other aspect I wanted to take up, and that was exactly the cloud, which was up here in the forenoon. I say thank you for listening, and this publication you can find at that address.
So I wonder if we have any questions from the floor, and if you could very kindly maybe just give us a line about yourself as you ask a question. Yes, that gentleman there. Thank you. Were you raising your hand there? Perfect. Thank you.
I'm Pekka Olspu. I come from the Oulu University Library from Finland. I have just a simple question for Markus Stump. What prevents Vienna University Press from becoming fully open access publisher? Why don't you just publish all the books open access? because it's not a question of money. You just showed your sales figures. It's not a question of that.
Great question. Thank you.
Well, I cannot speak for the Vienna University Press, but I think it's the author's right. It's the decision of the book series. Each one has his own politics. If they have the track doing it this way or this way, in my book series, we decided to do it open access. And, well, I think we are not that prominent to be a role model for other scientists, but it would be nice.
Yes, you could be a role model, of course.
It would be
you
nice.
A really, really big university, you would really be a good example for everyone. Yeah.
Thank you. Great question. Thank you. Any other questions? Lars?
It's in a way more of a comment, but Katarzyna, when you showed on your PowerPoint, it was library, bibliometrics, and publishing, and the name of the institution was the Center of Scientific and Technical Information. And we have seen that libraries have got new services and often a new name, at least for a period. In this university, we call the library a learning center. Some years ago, now we call it library again. But I like that.
A lot of higher education, and we decided to distinguish the bibliometric analysis to support the evaluation process.
Yeah.
It's because of a new. As I said, these requirements in new law on higher education.
Yeah.
That's why. And it's all collected. We are still all librarians, and we do librarians. So all the same job all the time. But we wanted to be seen and to have this possibility to... develop, also on another fields of activity, to take part in the evaluation process. And that's why, and we hope that we will be more visible, maybe.
I think it's a good idea to promote the new services. In a way, with a new name, the traditional library, and then the new services.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But I have one comment to Mikael, because in the Norwegian, we have a library law in Norway that gives a mission statement to the public libraries that they shall promote debate and democracy through debate. And they do that with a lot of events. And of course, if they do events and debates, why shouldn't they also take responsibility for publishing? Because in our university, we started the other way. We started with publishing, and then we say, well, we buy books, we lend them out, we publish. Why shouldn't we also have debates and events? And it's simple. And it's, I mean, in the United States, 50% of the STEM PhDs are recruited by the nuclear weapon industry. And 100 American universities cooperate with the nuclear weapon industry. And that will, if the UN treaty on abolition of nuclear weapon becomes one part of the justice, we are not allowed to cooperate with those 100 universities anymore. So it's a theme we need to discuss.
Well, I just tell you that I have noted this change in the library law in Norway, and I think it's very significant that it is in the law that the librarians are taking part in the public debate. But I didn't get your point, really, the last point, but I remember that the Norwegian Library Associations, as far as I know, the only ones in the world, made a statement in support of Julian Assange some 7 years ago already. And that's great.
Thank you, there's a question from the lady there, and then I think we'll probably wrap up just in terms of time. I have one quick question for Sue-Ann as well.
Okay,
and
thank you.
Wrap up for the break.
My name is Marte Ryste, and I'm working with Open Access Publishing in a professional academic publishing house in Norway, Kaplendam Akademisk. Thank you all for interesting talks. I had one question for Sue-Ann Gardner. Yeah, I was wondering, when you measure the cost of your publications, what you include, do you also include the cost for staff and offices, etc.? Is this, yeah. So, sorry, you can answer. Yeah, and the other question was, when it comes to editorial work, do you also work on project ideas, improving text? You said copy editing, but are you also working, you know, editorial work basic with the authors and texts, or are you doing copy editing of the text? Thank you.
So I had on one slide what the cost consisted of, and so it's one of those slides. It's staff and overhead, salaries and overhead, the platform, the equipment, and there was one other item there. So that's what I'm basing it on, what we base it on. That's, yes. And those are our costs, as simple as that. And then about editing, you're asking me about, like, do we do more than just copy editing? Yes, the authors will come in and sit with us, and we talk about their projects. We help them develop their projects. So we acquire the projects, then we develop the projects, then we, you know, do the production aspects. Copy editing is a production element that's kind of instrumental. You know, you just do it. You don't need the author there. But then we give the author proofs, and they review the proofs, and we get them back and then make changes based on that. But beyond that, you're talking about, like, content editing, and we do some of that. It, like I said, the authors drive the projects, and if they ask for that, we give it to them. And if they don't ask for that, we don't impose it on them.
Just one last question, and then we'll take the break. Just, you mentioned friction in terms of, even amongst the library community, in terms of promoting awareness of library publishing. We've set up a group in Ireland, a national library publishing group. Helen Fallon, who Mikhail referred to there on the on one of the publications, sits on that group. How have you overcome that amongst your peers?
Yes, this is a lot. This could be long. I won't take a long time. But this is important. We feel that if there's friction, this is good, really, because it means we're doing something that's changing something. And we don't want bad friction. Okay, when it gets to that point, when it becomes toxic or something, then, you know, we pull back. But sometimes it just opens a dialogue. So what we do is we open dialogue. We talk about it. We listen. What is bothering you about this, and how can we change things? We like to get to a place where it's comfortable for everyone. That's not always possible. It's an ongoing thing. And we push things so there is some friction. You know, it's part of what we do. But it has to be balanced.
Thank you. Well, that's a good note to end on. And thank you to all the speakers, and maybe a round of applause. Really thought-provoking talks. Thank you all.
I think it's a really good sign that great discussions are kicking off, that we're slow getting started again. So the next session is about library publishing services. And the first person up is Lars Egeland, our host. And Lars is going to be talking about evaluation of OA journals, and that is recommendations for a future role for the library. Thank you, Lars.
Thank you. And we've had an evaluation of some of our open access journals, but the main thing is the recommendation for the future role for the library. This is the open access journal landscape in Norway. You know, Norway is a long country. If you turn Norway round, you'll get down to the south of Italy. About 100 journals from Norwegian publishers are registered in the DOYA directory. Approximately, I think that's correct, 26 are published by the Scandinavian University Press, Universitetsforlaget, and 16 are published by other commercial publishers. And the rest are published by Norwegian universities, mainly libraries. I think two or three are published from other parts of the university, and mainly without APCs. The background is, of course, the OpenS initiative. And in Norway, the Research Council say that from 2021, there will be no financial support to journals that are not open access, or to research projects that doesn't publish open access. Within the libraries, we have consortia who have made contract with Elsevier, Wiley, Taylor & Francis, and Springer Nature, pointing towards open access. That really means that the libraries pay more than we used to, because we also paid for the what used to be the APCs. And then we have some financial support for turning Norwegian journals in humanities and social sciences into open access. 25 journals get support from the Research Council for that. And they are mainly published by the Scandinavian University Press. Somebody asked, why doesn't we reclaim the control over academic publishing? Maybe we don't do that because there is no free lunch. It costs money to publish, whether with all the business models we can imagine. And I've described some business model, the consortia agreement, as I told you about from Norway, between libraries and publishers, pointing towards open access, or at least hybrid publishing. And then commercial open access publishers with APC, like Cappelen Damm, who spoke here, and the Scandinavian University Press. And then publishing from universities based on APC. I think it's one or two journals in Norway based on APCs. Commercial open access publishers with funding from foundations or universities. And that's, we have a lot of examples on that too. The last one is publishing by universities, funded by the universities, societies, or foundations. And that's what we are doing, but that isn't free either. So University Press, they have their platform, Idun, and this is an example, Studia Musicologica Norvegica, which is published by Universitetsforlaget in collaboration with Norwegian Musicological Society and with support from the National Consortium for Humanities and Social Sciences. So they went to the University Press and said, could you publish this for us? And they will have to pay money to the Scandinavian University Press for that. And yeah. And then we have Oslo Met's open access journals, started in 2011, and we have today 15 journals. And I say we run 15 journals now. Some of the journals run by Universitetsforlaget has come to us and said, how much do we have to pay to you for you to run it? We say, well, it's much cheaper. Not that cheap as in Denmark, but it's much cheaper. But we don't promote many services. So then they have gone to the University Press and said, we want all the services, so we prefer to pay more money to the University Press instead. Some of these journals was established journals that was flipped into open access, like Journal for Kindergarten Research, but most of them were established by engaged researchers. And the initiative for most journals came from researchers, and this is a university for professions, and none of the professions said, if we want to constitute an academic field, then we need a journal. And since that journal doesn't exist, we have to make it. It was very limited economical support. And I think the idea was that the journal should evolve from a strategic project into a normal operating budget in the university. There was no strategic institutional strategy behind the establishing. And the idea was that they would be self-sufficient from income, from incentives, from publishing, or from APCs. And many of these journals were also established in cooperation with other universities. And I guess some of them had the idea that in the future we would share the costs, and then it would run. The platform and the policy, all journals are published with an CC BY license. Reading, publishing, and submission of articles are free, published on an OGS platform. All journals are registered in the directory of open access journals, and also registered in the Norwegian list of accepted publication channels. The role of the library was that we are responsible for the technical platform. We give training to editors and editorial secretaries, and we organize annual meetings for the journals to increase cooperation. We help with indexing, and we promote templates for the articles, metadata, and tagging. The service from the library is free, as long as the journal has some connection with Oslo Metropolitan University. And that means that if they haven't had any connection with Oslo Metropolitan University, they recruit somebody from the academic staff in Oslo Metropolitan University to be a part of the editorial board, and then they get it for free. But we have said that to be relevant, the policy is that every journal should publish at least 6 articles a year. And that's part of the recognition by the Norwegian Research Agency that maximum 2/3 of the authors can come from Oslo Met. And Faculty of Education and International Studies, they decided to have an external evaluation of 6 of their 6 journals. And there was an evaluation team consisted of people from the Norwegian Institute of Research in Education, University of Southeast Norway, and the other university in Oslo, the University of Oslo. And the evaluation covers the period between 2014 and 2018. And the evaluation report was published late 2019. The mandate was to go into peer review processes, routines, and quality. The scope of the journal, the need, the niche of the journal, bibliometrics, citations, look at readers and the number of downloads, look into editorial boards, the qualification of editorial boards, the reputation and who were the authors, research ethics, and quality of routines and processes from submission to publishing. Their report says that they have between 50 and 66 articles every year. Some journals had very few articles, some had more. the proportion of articles from Norwegian institutions was 59%. 21% come from Oslo Met. And some commented that in some of the journals there weren't any publication from Oslo Met, but they paid for the publishing. But if you look to Oslo Met has 12% of all articles in the disciplines, in the educational disciplines, of the total numbers in the Norwegian CRIS systems. And 10% of all articles from this university are published in these open access journals. So that means it has a significant contribution to the number of publications in the university. This is perhaps obvious that the benefits of having a portfolio of open access journals is to contribute to open access to research, it's good for the reputation of the university to publish open access journals, and also to stimulate researchers at this university to publish. Gris, smiling. The recommendation from the evaluation committee was that all journals are able to justify their existence. The quality was okay. But they said there might come initiatives for new journals. And that means that it's needed to have some criteria to avoid over-establishing. And that means that perhaps some of those journals that we publish should be closed, also to give room for new journals. Editorial operations vary a lot, they said. There is a need for standardization to increase effective resource use in the long run. What are the alternatives to institutional publishing? Of course, the researchers can publish in other journals. They doesn't always exist. Or they have a level which will result in that the number of articles published by our researchers will decrease. One of the things the evaluation committee wanted to look into was if it was so that researchers published their first articles in our own journals and then later went to international journals. That wasn't the result. They continued to publish in our journals because the journals very often became very central journals in their field. We could buy services from commercial publishers. That is more expensive. We could discuss that because some of the business models are that you pay per article from the publisher. And I guess it's not always more expensive to buy services from commercial publishers as Cappelen Damm. But often it will be. And the question is, do the commercial publishers have a higher quality than we have in our journals? And there is the idea behind the evaluation was that the quality of our own journals were low, but that didn't find that. So the conclusion from the evaluation committee was that maintaining the portfolio will demand a more systematic economical and editorial support from the institution. And then everyone, it's wonderful to hear, everyone is satisfied with the service from the library. But the library can offer more and wider support. The library does not have the experience, the competence, or the support as a professional publisher today, but the library employs more and more people with PhD and international experience from publishing. Therefore, it is an option that the library develop more as a publishing house with editorial competence, offer courses, and build editorial competence, access the journals, and maybe also initiative national networks. So, yeah. So this is what we are discussing in our university now, the role of the a wider role for the library in publishing. And at the same time, there was an initiative from the university in Tromsø, and University in Oslo and Oslo Met to establish a national group among higher education institutions to study models for business, cooperation between universities, technical demands, and so on for library publishing in Norway or in Scandinavia. And that has been discussed in the library committee for the universities where I'm sitting, and we said that this is very interesting. We'll have to discuss it with the committee for research, and there is a committee for publishing, and if they agree, we'll make a project on how could libraries in Norway cooperate on publishing. Yeah. That was it.
Thank you very much, Lars. I think that that a process like going through an evaluation like that is of huge benefit, you know, to signpost developments, future developments in the university. The next talk that we have is by Aysa Akanger and Solveig Enoksen. And they're from the University Library in Tromsø, the Arctic University of Norway. And they're going to talk. Are you talking on your own?
Yep.
Okay. So Solveig is going to talk about support for good peer review.
Right. Thank you. This is going to not come out of my hair without a fight. Okay, so together with my colleague Aysa, we put together this presentation about how a library publisher can best help journals get a good peer review process. So we work at, or we give technical support in Septentrio Academic Publishing, which is a publishing service offered by the university library for open access journals associated with UiT, the Arctic University of Norway. And aside from technical support with the platform and so on, we also offer advice on other aspects of the publishing process, including peer review. Yeah. And so we have now started to look into how to get the review process up to a good level. That did not work. Oh, there we are. So Septentrio has 10 peer-reviewed journals. It's hosted on the Open Journal Systems platform. And we have a wide variety of disciplines. And also some of our journals have guest issues that where guest editors do the whole process, including the review process, and that adds to the necessity for good support. All right, so for good peer review, there's two main issues. One is ethical standards, and the other is technicalities pertaining to keeping the anonymity during the blind review process of single-blind and double-blind reviews. So there are things that both authors, reviewers, and editors need to know about. And there are the technicalities need to be in place so that they're able to comply with these. And they should also be reminded of these throughout the process. And when it's when we talk about types of peer review, in September we have most of our journals use the double-blind peer review, and only two use single-blind, whereas for the rest of the journal world, it's flipped, so it's mostly single-blind. And as most of our journals use double-blind, that adds to the support need with extra, because there's extra work with keeping the anonymity of also authors. And perhaps we can use this this one here. Ooh. Yeah. To have our journals open up a little bit more in the process. Have more journals use the single blind review process, perhaps. Okay, so when it comes to ethical standards in peer review, there are different principles and guidelines and so on by different associations. And the main or the good place to start is the principles of transparency and best practice in scholarly publishing, put together by the Committee on Publication Ethics, the Open Access Scholarly Publishers Association, the Director of Open Access Journals, and the World Association of Medical Editors. And, of course, also COPE's ethical guidelines for peer reviewers. Among these standards, there are some that are more important for us and for the editors of our journals. One is ensuring against bias and competing interests and accommodating for appropriate feedback, and how editors can handle inappropriate reviews, and what or how reviewers can notify editors of suspicions of ethics violations. And COPE also says that you should have these standards in your guidelines, and therefore these guidelines must be available somewhere. Okay, so for bias and competing interests, of course there should be a competing interest statement in the journal's reviewer guidelines, but it should also be visible in the review process. So, and they should also require a competing interest statement from the reviewers and encourage them to also list anything that might be a competing interest. And OJS has this functionality where you can make this a pop-up during the review process. When it comes to appropriate feedback, we've all heard these stories about people who've gotten these really horrible feedbacks. Maybe some have gotten them themselves. And of course, the journal, again, needs to list this in the questions they want answered in the guidelines. But another way to do this is to use the review forms, where the editorial board has put together a list of questions that are detailing what they want answered. And this also makes it possible to compare reviews between different reviewers. So that's an added benefit of using the review forms. So what do the editor do if there's still an inappropriate review? Well, in OJS, you have this function to revert the decision of a review, which basically unconsiders the review. It's still there in the system, but it's not sent to the author. And but it will be still there for future reference, but it's not considered. And also for future reference, you can rate the reviewer and add an editorial note saying why you should not be using this reviewer again. Okay, so what if the reviewer suspects a violation of ethics? Of course, you can send an email, but we all know that emails tend to disappear in this black hole that's called the inbox. And also when editors leave, you don't have access to that anymore. So most journals have the option of giving feedback that is only sent to the editor during the review process. And there's also, in OGS at least, the possibility of adding a discussion that is only between the reviewer and the journal editor. And this is possible to do both before and after the review process. So if you discover something after you sent your review, you can still send this and the editor will be notified. All right, so ensuring the blind review or double blind in the case of most of our journals. So there's different things that everyone needs to be aware of. Usually the platform has, there's functions that will keep the anonymity, but there's still things that people need to remember. So for authors during the double blind review, they have to check the manuscript and replication data so that they've removed their affiliation name and if they have acknowledged their research lab in their manuscript, they need to remove that. And also if they've used a data repository, they need to let the curators know that these data will be used in the in a double-blind review process. There's also the issue of file properties and comments. So the system adds last edited by and then your name. And you need to know how to remove this. Conflict of interest statement is also one thing. You should give, or authors should give, a general statement saying that there is a conflict of interest or there is not a conflict of interest that is sent to the reviewer, and then a longer one detailing the conflict of interest to the editor. And then there's the issue of preprints. So this is something that the journal has to decide upon first. So if whether they want to allow preprints or not, and if they want to allow preprints, they need to let the author know that we can't ensure that your anonymity is still there if you post it. So that would be up to the author then. All right, reviewers, there's a little bit less that they have to check, but one thing is the review report, that to not put their names in the report part that goes to the author. That has happened. And also the same with file properties. The editor has to monitor all of this and make sure that everything is, or all identifying information is removed before sending things between author and reviewer. And where to find this information is author guidelines and reviewer guidelines. There's also in OGS a pop-up with how to ensure a blind review. That is mainly pertaining to the file properties and comments. And also, the editors need to know about this, of course, and we are putting together this editorial resources where we list all of this. And there's also the training we as support staff give the editors. All right. So to sum up, there are ethical standards and technicalities that everyone needs to be aware of and that they need to be able to comply with and should be reminded of. And we as support staff, or if we as a library publisher help facilitate this, it makes the process much better and of a much better quality. And it's also standardized and much easier for everyone involved, hopefully. That's the plan at least. All right. Thank you. And that's Aisa.
Thanks so much, Solveig. That was a really interesting discussion on the peer review process. and building standards into it. So the next talk that we have is from Talia Anderson. And Talia is from Washington State University, and she's going to be speaking on the important issue of library publishing and accessibility.
Okay, yeah. So my name is Talia Anderson, and I am talking about accessibility and library publishing. And I wanted to start with a couple of caveats, one being that I initially, in thinking about this presentation, was thinking of it as a discussion, and so I made the scope a little large. Web accessibility, of course, is a pretty large issue. I will also be, because I'm based in the Northwestern United States, that's primarily the context I'll be speaking from in some of the things that I'm talking about here. So a bit of context, at least in the United States, web accessibility is something that has gained increasing attention, in part because of a real rise in the number of lawsuits that have been brought forward against organizations that have web pages that aren't really particularly accessible. A lot of these have been on the basis of Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. And they have pointed out that services provided that are supposed to be provided to the general public should be accessible as well. So libraries, largely by implication at this point, have been involved then in doing more reviews of accessibility. And, of course, in libraries we have this issue. We have many accessibility issues to still address. There have been studies increasingly looking at more of the kind of staple fare of library publishing, things like open access journals, institutional repositories, open educational resources. And these studies have really pointed out that, again, we have many issues with all sorts of things to do with the alt tags and the headers, reading order, and all the things that you often talk about it with accessibility. In discussions of these issues, then, there have been people pointed out challenges that libraries face, that we have potentially limited staffing to look at accessibility. We have sometimes limited access to tools, limited funding, and then also often a proliferation of resources that are already, that were not born digital and have accessibility issues as a result, or that were created by faculty members or others outside of the libraries and therefore may have these accessibility issues. Another challenge that I'll mention is really perhaps a tendency to take accessibility and reduce it to a bit of a checklist, to think about it in a checklist fashion. So that is to take sort of the web content accessibility guidelines and to break it down into a set of things to check off, to say, now this is accessible. It's all been checked off. And a couple of problems with that. One, I think in the libraries, maybe there's a tendency to kind of shift responsibility over to the systems or technical services area rather than individuals all kind of taking responsibility for creating accessible content. Another issue, I think, is that this tends to lose sight of users that we're actually attempting to reach with these materials and can kind of sidestep the issue. For instance, one critique of the kind of common accessibility studies out there have pointed out that often these studies are put forward on the basis of using an automated tool, and so they present like a percentage of accessibility. One issue with that being that it can overstate problems that may be relatively minor for somebody actually using that material. And it may understate a problem that only appears once, but is very significant for somebody using assistive devices. So in the rest of my presentation, kind of an attempt to avoid this checklist mentality, I'm not really going to talk about the common things, again, that are discussed with accessibility, like the alt tags and so on. I actually just want to sort of take a step back and look at accessibility from the vantage point of values, a kind of values-based approach to thinking about taking on accessibility issues within libraries and within library publishing. So the values that I am going to speak on the basis of are, I've taken these from a discussion of open pedagogy, actually. And the reason I did this is because I felt like these values already aligned well with values in libraries. Also, I think that open pedagogy, because it positions people as both kind of co-creators and learners simultaneously, I think that's a good approach for many of us. I'll just speak for myself, still kind of learning about accessibility and good practices in this area. So the first value then that I wanted to mention is responsibility. And when I say responsibility, I'm really thinking about a practice of interrogating the potential gaps between our vision in libraries, which are very idealistic and very much about open knowledge, and then potentially the practices that may fall short. So just an anecdote to go along with that. For me, I am a scholarly communication librarian at my institution, which means that I manage an institutional repository. And my institutional repository has a lot of accessibility issues. The documents in it have many issues. One of the things that I've begun thinking about is that it would be lovely if our repository had a policy actually addressing this and potentially providing contact information and pointing out the sort of division of responsibility between what the library is planning on doing and what we expect people contributing to the repository to do. This graphic here, so actually, of course, being a librarian, my first step in this process was to go see what other people have already done with policies regarding accessibility and IRs. And I work at a public land grant institution, and I decided to look at other public land grant institution IRs. I ended up looking at about 63, and 25 of them had policies. Which was great, although I will say that 18 of them were basically stock text from Elsevier for their digital commons platform, so not necessarily from libraries. One policy I did like came from Cornell, and so they again talked about what the library is planning on doing regarding accessibility with the IR, and then also what they expect researchers to do when they contribute papers. They provided contact information and talked about what they'll be doing in the future. So these were all great. My IR, by the way, still sadly doesn't have a policy. We're still discussing how that will go in the future here. So the next value I wanted to mention is curiosity. And with curiosity, really what I'm thinking about here is the desire, the willingness to ask questions about who our users are and to learn more about our users that we're reaching with these publications. So another anecdote, this is something I was thinking about while talking to a colleague who works on publishing open educational resources. As part of the end process for her of publishing her OER, she takes a Pressbooks instance and then converts it to a PDF. And one of the things that she was noticing, so she works at a STEM-heavy institution, so a lot of her texts have a lot of math notation, engineering notation, and so on. And she was finding that in transitioning to a PDF out of Pressbooks, she was losing all of the MathML, the really good tags that actually made those equations meaningful for somebody studying engineering or studying math. So for her, she was told by technically that these materials were accessible, but she really had to think about her students and what they actually would need, which as a result meant really reinterrogating the entire workflow for publishing these books, thinking about what staff they needed and what they needed to completely change this process to make something useful for their students. So another value then, empathy. And by empathy, I'm really thinking of something a little beyond curiosity to really getting at the experiences of people coming from the side of using assistive devices and potentially having disabilities. One study that I appreciated that I think connected to this value was by another colleague, Michelle Reed, at the University of Texas at Arlington. And Michelle partnered actually with students in the Disability Studies program at her university, and use the students to help her do a review of accessibility of the OER that that they publish there. And so in her paper, this is a quote from the paper, she outlined some of the really common accessibility issues that, we see across the board, really, with OER. But this is a paragraph that I especially appreciated because in it, the authors kind of take a step back again, and they talk about, you know, really the perspective that informs the creation of these OER. And they point out here that a lot of these textbooks really are imagined for students who are completely able-bodied. They don't have any kind of disability. They point out that the real issue here is not even imagining a student with a disability in the first place. And, you know, the difficulty of actually thinking about accessibility when you don't even have that audience in mind. I think, again, this kind of thinking is useful as like a way of stepping back and then beginning to conceive of accessibility practices. And then the last thing I'll mention is participation. And here I'm thinking about, you know, who is actually creating these resources? How diverse is that group of creators, both the librarians and also faculty members and others who are creating these materials? I think Open Pedagogy puts forward a great example of a way to increase that diversity. A screenshot of a textbook that's been marked up using Hypothesis to collect notes from students on a text. I have a colleague, this isn't a screenshot from the colleagues project, but a colleague at my university is working with students right now with a psychology textbook and asking them to help her really think about the diversity of the examples used in the book and of the language as well. And that's one way that she's trying to, you know, improve the textbook by making it more, present better for a more diverse audience. I will say, so alongside this kind of strategy, there's also thinking about hiring practices. You know, libraries, of course, are infamously white, infamously not particularly diverse. And thinking about getting more diversity in terms of ability as well, I think would be really useful for us in thinking about our accessibility practices going forward into the future. So that is really all I wanted to talk about. I would, of course, welcome hearing about other perspectives and so on, and I think that would come up in the question and answer. So.
Thanks so much, Talia. That was fantastic. I think that this is a really fitting end session for today, where we've been discussing really, you know, library publishers as guardians of quality and standards, and you know, there's no point in just having openness without having accessibility of that openness. Can I ask the speakers to come down, and maybe the audience would like to put some questions to them? So, you have a question.
You start. Oh, it doesn't matter. I think I may have more than one question, but I only ask one this time. And that is, I have to make sure I'm asking it. I can't ask it of you, Talia. But I was wondering if accessibility is as big a deal now in Europe and other countries as it is in the U.S. Last summer, the Los Angeles Public Library System, Los Angeles Community College Library System lost a very large lawsuit against the National Institute for the Blind. And the ruling, in effect, said it wasn't just the publishers who are responsible for making their information accessible, but the responsibility lies with the institution and the library. And that is... I don't know if that's a big change, but to all of us in the U.S., it seemed like a huge sea change that suddenly placed a level of responsibility on us that we have never had before. So if the publisher doesn't deliver the product we need, it then, I think, becomes incumbent on us, until there's an appeal or the ruling is modified, it becomes incumbent upon us to make that accessibility happen. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering what the situation is outside of the U.S.
Does anybody want to talk to that? Say what?
Maybe somebody in the audience that can speak for the rest of Europe. I can say something about Norway. We have a law on law on accessibility, which was really implemented for 2 or 3 years ago. And from 1st of January 2021, it's going to be implemented for all universities. And I know the Scandinavian airline system, they had to pay a lot of money because their web page wasn't accessible enough. And we are working rather hard now this year to make sure that all our services are accessible. That means, for instance, with us, with the film archive, that everything has to be text. So there is a lot of work to be done. And there have been some discussions about databases, but as far as I know, there have only been discussions. I don't think the law will require that we are responsible for results from databases. But there have been discussions about library systems, for instance, for people with dyslexia. How do you search in library systems?
Do you know more? Well, I know they're trying to make, if you want to be outside, they want to make it more accessible for everyone. In Norway as well?
I think what I meant was heading in your database direction, which is that, as I understood the ruling, now Talia may be able to jump in and clarify or help. But for instance, if I take a subscription to the Times of London, the newspaper, and if the Times of London has an accessibility statement, but it is lacking in certain elements, I may, as a library in the U.S., be vulnerable for that, because it is also my responsibility. So that I think that's how far the ruling last summer went. Now, there is hope that some of that may be modified on appeal next year.
Yeah, I haven't read super deep into it, so I can't really clarify, but that sounds, I definitely feel that I've heard, for people who have been hired on to focus on accessibility at libraries, it does seem like they are also focused on looking at, very carefully at, databases and subscriptions for vendors as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jesper, did you have a question?
Yes, something completely different. The evaluation you talked about, is that publicly available?
I'm not sure whether it's published, but you can. It's not closed, so I can give it to you. That's no problem. But I don't think it has been published on any platform. Yeah, you can read it, but it's in Norwegian, so.
Does anybody else have any questions for our speakers?
I have another one if no one does. And this may be a very European thing that I'm not understanding fully, but I've heard people here say, we will publish XYZ, but if the faculty, the scholars, want services, they have to go elsewhere. And I don't understand what the continuum is between services and going elsewhere for other services. Isn't it all just kind of one long line where maybe you just have an institutional repository, and then down here at the end you've got not just peer review, but you've got your visual abstracts and the whole thing. But it felt as though people were speaking about a dividing line after which the library would not provide a service. I found that confusing.
Well, in Norwegian, we have two terms. Utgiver, that's publisher. Forlag, that's also publisher. Or perhaps is it more publishing house or university press? I think most of the libraries that publish in Norway, they take the role as more of a technical publisher. And the editors are on faculties. And that was the point of the evaluation that I described, that suddenly the faculties discovered how much they paid for the editors working around in the at the faculties. So it's a discussion, how far should the services be? How far should the libraries go in their services towards on the publishing field?
So it's going to be a local choice, right?
Yeah.
Because QU in Australia was, you know, way out there with their video abstracts and all of that. So any library can make a choice to be anywhere along the continuum?
Yeah. Yeah, that's only a question of resources, I would guess. Yeah. And for some of you, during the breakout session tomorrow, you can see the studios that we have, because we produce the same films. And that's a historically coincidence that part of the organization that was given to the library was a media section with 10 people working with producing films.
So there's a great opportunity there for your video abstracts as well. Does it? So Sue Ann, you have a question?
So Solveig, do you know of any examples of when a reviewer has been complained about, and there's been abusive reviewing, and what how it's been resolved, like how that system has been used effectively?
Yeah, we had one instance last year when an editor said, okay, we've got this really inappropriate review, and how do we deal with this? And then we told them to use this revert decision function.
We also had a situation like that, that it was almost because of the anonymity that there can be a kind of a troll-like behavior. So we just made a note and didn't use that reviewer again and passed it on to somebody else. Does anybody else have a question? Okay, well, listen, thank you so much. Lars, that was great. Solveig and Talia, thank you.